This is Word of Mouth on NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today, Neil Gaiman from Writers on a New England Stage. Gaiman's Sandman series of comic books is credited for extending the genre's fan base beyond white males and teenagers. His children's book and later film, Coraline, redefined what is scary for kids. His groundbreaking 2002 novel, American Gods, won awards for horror, fantasy, and science fiction. Gaiman is a true multimedia sensation. He's made short films, recorded music, and wrote a recent episode for the television series Doctor Who. With 1.6 million Twitter followers, Gaiman has created a through line to his fan base, regularly posting works in progress, updates, and responses to his eager followers, many of whom wonder what's wrong if his tweets drop off for a bit. As he took the stage at the sold-out Portsmouth Music Hall, Neil Gaiman shared his warmth, wit, and eye for strange details before reading from the newly released 10th anniversary edition of American Gods.
I was sitting backstage probably 10 minutes before going on. Everything today was one of those days when planes don't take off and then they don't land. And once they have landed, very, 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 very nice limo drivers don't quite know how to get from hotels to music halls. And so you see so much more of Portsmouth than ever you'd wanted to. Do you know you have a submarine? You must know you have a submarine. Yes, it's the Albacore, which is an very American Gods sort of thing. I was asked last night during an interview about whether or not I felt, having lived in America for longer and also just the nature of the world, whether the strangeness that I was writing about in American Gods had gone away. And I was saying, no, it really hasn't. You know, it tends to go away for people in a certain location, obviously. You know, when I moved from England to America, to a small town in the Midwest, I would say to them, don't you think it's strange that you park a car on the ice? And then you take bets on when it's going to go through the ice in the spring. And they'd look at me as if I was mad. And I'm sure for everyone around here, the idea that you have a large submarine parked in a ditch surrounded by concrete is absolutely normal. You know, of course we do. Yeah, that's the Albacore. What are you talking about? Doesn't everybody have a submarine? It can't be a proper town it doesn't have a submarine. You know. So I picked a few bits from American Gods that I thought I would read. All the way through American Gods, which is a big book about gods in America, a little short stories that expand the story and try and shed light on the process of coming to America. And this was the first one that I wrote and the first one in the book. They navigated the green sea by the stars and by the shore. And when the shore was only a memory and the night sky was overcast and dark, they navigated by faith. And they called on the All-Father to bring them safely to land once more. A bad journey they had of it, their fingers numb and with a shiver in their bones that not even wine could burn off. They would wake in the morning to see that the rime had frosted their beards, and until the sun warmed them, they looked like old men, white-bearded before their time. Teeth were loosening, and eyes were deep sunken in their sockets when they made landfall on the green land to the west. The men said, "We are far, far from our homes and our hearths, far from the seas we know and the lands we love. Here, on the edge of the world, we will be forgotten by our gods." Their leader clambered to the top of a great rock, and he mocked them for their lack of faith. "The All-Father made the world," he shouted. "He built it with his hands from the shattered bones and the flesh of Ymir, his grandfather. He placed Ymir's brains in the sky as clouds, and his salt blood became the seas that we crossed. If he made the world, do you not realize that he created this land as well? And if we die here as men, shall we not be received into his hall? And the men cheered and laughed. They set to with a will to build a hall out of split trees and mud, inside a small stockade of sharpened logs, although as far as they knew, they were the only men in the new land. On the day that the hall was finished, there was a storm. The sky at midday became as dark as night, and the sky was rent with forks of white flame, and the thunder crashes were so loud that the men were almost deafened by them, and the ship's cat that they brought with them for good fortune hid beneath the beached longboat. The storm was hard enough and vicious enough that the men laughed and clapped each other on the back, and they said, "The Thunderer is here with us in this distant land," and they gave thanks and rejoiced, and they drank until they were reeling. In the smoky darkness of their hall that night, the bard sang them the old songs. He sang of Odin, the All-Father, who was sacrificed to himself as bravely and as nobly as others were sacrificed to him. He sang of the 9 days that the All-Father hung from the world tree, his side pierced and dripping from the spear point. At this point, his song became for a moment a scream. And he sang them all the things the All-Father had learned in his agony, 9 names and 9 runes and 2×9 charms. When he told them of the spear piercing Odin's side, the bard shrieked in pain as the All-Father himself had called out in his agony, and all the men shivered, imagining his pain. They found the Skraeling the following day, which was the All-Father's own day. He was a small man, his long hair black as a crow's wing, his skin the color of rich red clay. He spoke in words none of them could understand, not even their bard, who had been on a ship that had sailed through the Pillars of Hercules, and who could speak the trader's pigeon men spoke all across the Mediterranean. The stranger was dressed in feathers and in furs, and there were small bones braided into his long hair. They led him into their encampment, and they gave him roasted meat to eat and strong drink to quench his thirst. They laughed riotously at the man as he stumbled and sang, at the way his head rolled and lolled, and this on less than a drinking horn of mead. They gave him more drink, and soon enough he lay beneath the table with his head curled under his arm. Then they picked him up, a man at each shoulder, a man at each leg, carried him at shoulder height, the 4 men making him an 8-legged horse. And they carried him at the head of a procession to an ash tree on the hill overlooking the bay, where they put a rope around his neck and hung him high in the wind, their tribute to the All-Father, the gallows lord. The Skraeling's body swung in the wind, his face blackening, his tongue protruding, his eyes popping, his penis hard enough to hang a leather helmet on, while the men cheered and shouted and laughed, proud to be sending their sacrifice to the heavens. And the next day, when 2 huge ravens landed upon the Skraeling's corpse, one on each shoulder, and commenced to peck at its cheeks and eyes, the men knew that their sacrifice had been accepted. It was a long winter, and they were hungry, but they were cheered by the thought that when spring came, they would send the boat back to the Northlands, and it would bring settlers and bring women. As the weather became colder and the days became shorter, some of the men took to searching for the Skraeling village, hoping to find food and women. They found nothing save for the places where fires had been, where small encampments had been abandoned. One midwinter's day, when the sun was as distant and cold as a dull silver coin, they saw that the remains of the Skraeling's body had been removed from the ash tree. That afternoon, it began to snow in huge, slow flakes. The men from the Northlands closed the gates of their encampment, retreated behind their wooden wall. The Skraeling war party fell upon them that night, 500 men to 30. They climbed the wall, and over the following 7 days, they killed each of the 30 men in 30 different ways. And the sailors were forgotten by history and their people. The wall they tore down and the village they burned. The longboat, upside down and pulled high on the shingle, they also burned, hoping that the pale strangers had but one boat, and that by burning it, they were ensuring that no other Northmen would come to their shores. It was more than 100 years before Leif the Fortunate, son of Eric the Red, rediscovered that land, which he would call Vinland. His gods were already waiting for him when he arrived, Tyr one-handed, and Grey Odin, gallows god, and Thor of the thunders. They were there. They were waiting. Now, you might not actually know this, but actually, American Gods is a novel about a man called Shadow who gets out of prison and winds up working for a rather mysterious old gentleman who calls himself Wednesday and getting into all manner of trouble. And this is a little section from about 3/4 of the way through the book where he's living under an assumed name in a little town in Wisconsin, and he runs into somebody who sort of knows him. Her name is Sam. He gave her a lift, gave her a ride once much earlier. Shadow opened the garage door, and she started to laugh. "Oh, my God," she said when she saw the forerunner. "Paul Gunther's car. You bought Paul Gunther's car, oh my God." Shadow opened the door for her. Then he went around and got in. "You know the car?" "Oh, when I came up here 2 or 3 years ago to stay with Mags, it was me that persuaded him to paint it purple." "Oh," said Shadow, "it's good to have someone to blame." He drove the car out onto the street, got out and closed the garage door, got back into the car. Sam was looking at him oddly as he got in, as if the confidence had begun to leak out of her. He put on his seatbelt and she said, "I'm scared. This was a stupid thing to do, wasn't it? Getting into a car with a psycho killer." "I got you safe home last time," said Shadow. "You killed 2 men, she said. "You're wanted by the feds. And now I find out you're living under an assumed name next door to my sister. Unless Mike Ainsell is your real name?" "No," said Shadow, and he sighed. "It's not." He hated saying it. It was as if he was letting go of something important, abandoning Mike Ainsell by denying him, as if he were taking his leave of a friend. "Did you kill those men?"
"No."
"They came to my house and said we'd been seen together, and this guy showed me photographs of you. What was his name? Mr. Hat? No, Mr. Town. That was him. It was like The Fugitive. But I said I hadn't seen you."
"Well, thank you."
"So," she said, "tell me what's going on. I'll keep your secrets if you keep mine."
"I don't know any of yours,"
said Shadow. "Well, you know that it was my idea to paint this thing purple, thus forcing Paul Gunther to become such an object of scorn and derision for several counties around that he was forced to leave town entirely."
"We were kind of stoned," she admitted.
"I doubt that bit of it's much of a secret," said Shadow. "Everyone in Lakeside must have known. It's a stoner sort of purple." And then she said, very quiet, very fast, "If you're going to kill me, please don't hurt me. I shouldn't have come here with you. I'm so dumb. I am so fucking dumb. I should have run away or called the cops when I first saw you. I can identify you. Jesus, I am so dumb."
Shadow sighed. "I've never killed anybody, really. Now I'm going to take you to the buck," he said. "Or if you give the word, I'll turn this car around and take you home. I'll buy you a drink if you're actually old enough to drink, and I'll buy you a soda if you're not. Then I'll take you back to Marguerite, deliver you safe and sound, and hope you aren't going to call the cops." There was silence as they crossed the bridge.
"Who did kill those men?"
she asked. "You wouldn't believe me if I told you." I would. She sounded angry now. He wondered if bringing the wine to the dinner had been a wise idea. Life was certainly not a cabernet right now. It's a bumper sticker they see earlier in the chapter. It's not easy to believe. I, she told him, can believe anything. You have no idea what I can believe. Really? I can believe in things that are true, and I can believe things that aren't true, and I can believe things where nobody knows if they're true or not. I can believe in Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny and Marilyn Monroe and the Beatles and Elvis and Mr. Ed. And listen, I believe that people are perfectible, that knowledge is infinite, that the world is run by secret banking cartels and is visited by aliens on a regular basis. Nice ones that look like wrinkly lemurs and bad ones who mutilate cattle and want our water and our women. I believe that the future sucks, and I believe that the future rocks, and I believe that one day white buffalo woman is going to come back and kick everyone's ass. I believe that all men are just overgrown boys with deep problems communicating, and that the decline in good sex in America is coincident with the decline in drive-in movie theaters from state to state. I believe that all politicians are unprincipled crooks, and I still believe they're better than the alternative. I believe that California is going to sink into the sea when the big one comes, while Florida is just going to dissolve into madness and alligators and toxic waste. I believe that antibacterial soap is destroying our resistance to dirt and disease so that one day we'll all be wiped out by the common cold like the Martians in the War of the Worlds. I believe that the greatest poets of the last century were Edith Sitwell and Don Marquis, that jade is dried dragon sperm, that thousands of years ago in a former life I was a one-armed Siberian shaman. I believe that mankind's destiny lies in the stars. I believe that candy really did taste better when I was a kid, that it's aerodynamically impossible for a bumblebee to fly, that light is a wave and a particle, that there's a cat in a box somewhere who's alive and dead at the same time. Although if they don't ever open the box to feed it, it'll eventually just be two different kinds of dead. And that there are stars in the universe, billions of years older than the universe itself. I believe in a personal God who cares about me and worries and oversees everything I do. I believe in an impersonal God who set the universe in motion and went off to hang with her girlfriends and doesn't even know that I'm alive. I believe in an empty and godless universe of causal chaos, background noise, and sheer blind luck. I believe that anyone who says that sex is overrated just hasn't done it properly. I believe that anyone who claims to know what's going on will lie about the little things too. I believe in absolute honesty and sensible social lies. I believe in a woman's right to choose, a baby's right to live, that while all human life is sacred, there's nothing wrong with the death penalty if you can trust the legal system implicitly, and that no one but a moron would ever trust the legal system. I believe that life is a game, life is a cruel joke, and that life is what happens when you're alive, and that you might as well lie back and enjoy it. She stopped, out of breath. Shadow almost took his hands off the wheel to applaud. Instead, he said, "Okay, so if I tell you what I've learned, you won't think that I'm a nut." "Maybe," she said. "Try me." "Would you believe that all the gods that people have ever imagined are still with us today?" "Maybe." "And that there are new gods out there, gods of computers and telephones and whatever, and that they all seem to think there isn't room for them both in the world, and that some kind of war is kind of likely. And these gods killed those two men." "No, my wife killed those two men." "I thought you said your wife was dead." "She is. She killed them before she died then." "After." "Don't ask." She reached up a hand and flicked her hair from her forehead. They pulled up on Main Street, outside the "Buck Stops Here." The sign over the window showed a surprised-looking stag standing on its hind legs, holding a glass of beer. Shadow got out. He grabbed the bag with the book in it and got out. "Why would they have a war?" asked Sam. It seems kind of redundant. What is there to win?
I don't know, admitted Shadow.
It's easier to believe in aliens than in gods, said Sam. Maybe Mr. Town and Mr. Whatever were men in black, only the alien kind.
Maybe they were at that, said Shadow.
They were standing on the sidewalk outside the buck stops here, and Sam stopped. She looked up at Shadow, and her breath hung on the night air like a faint cloud. She said, just tell me you're one of the good guys.
I can't, said Shadow. I wish I could, but I'm doing my best.
Together anymore. Let me take a deep breath, babe. If you need me, me and Neil be hanging out with the Dream King. Neil should hide, by the way. I don't believe you're leaving, cause me and Charles Manson like the same ice cream.
That's Neil Gaiman from Writers on a New England Stage. I'm Virginia Prescott. In just a moment, Neil Gaiman answers questions from me and the audience about his process, Latter-day Gods, the power of story, and the perplexing question of which is better, Star Wars or Star Trek. That's more Neil Gaiman from Writers on a New England Stage when word of mouth returns after this short break. This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today, author Neil Gaiman from Writers on a New England Stage recorded in front of a live audience at the Portsmouth Music Hall. Before the break, we heard Gaiman reading from his novel, American Gods, just released in a 10th anniversary edition. The book is a sweeping work combining elements of ancient myth, fantasy, horror, Americana, and satire. Gaiman's prolific creativity and ready presence across media platforms has earned him a committed following. The event at the Music Hall quickly sold out. Gaiman showed some of his trademark transparency in an interview on stage. He spoke about his process, his read of American history, and what might go into a sequel to American Gods, including the emergence of new technological deities like Twitter.
Well, Neil Gaiman from Portsmouth, Old Hampshire, welcome to Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
Thank you. I've been getting these sad little twitters from people in the other Portsmouth for the last few weeks. Every time they see, I'm saying, yes, I'll be in Portsmouth. And they go, yes, well, oh, wrong Portsmouth. So.
They don't have a submarine, do they?
Not one just sort of sitting there randomly. They don't have the albacore.
Well, as you're looking back 10 years after writing American Gods, how do you think the book has aged?
I have absolutely no idea. I get to be, it's kind of like George Harrison once was asked about the Beatles, and he said, you have to understand that I'm one of the only four people for whom the Beatles didn't happen during the 60s. I have no idea what it was like to read Sandman when it was coming out, because I was writing Sandman. And I have no idea how American Gods has aged, because for me, it's still this thing that in some ways I'm still sitting in a borrowed house in Florida. I borrowed a house from my friend Tori Amos, and I just, yay. And I hid out there and wrote. And all I remember was the sheer bloody-minded fury of trying to get one word after another, what would happen when I get stuck. the coming to America stories were actually my way, in many ways, of getting around writer's block, which is a posh term for getting stuck on the stuff that you're writing.
Well, you said backstage, that backstage, not the one with, you know, skulls.
Yeah, yeah.
And you say in the book, in the introduction to the 10th edition, that you're considering, you know, maybe an American Gods too. And I'm wondering now, I mean, I was struck by how prescient it seemed in some ways. One of the agents was talking about, you know, freedom fighters and terrorism, and that's something that, this book came out months before September 11th, 2001.
It was actually kind of disturbing because it was published on the 19th of June, 2001, which was a Tuesday. I did a signing on a Tuesday in Borders Books in the World Trade Center. And the signing tour was very long, and it took me from all across America and then to the UK and all across the UK, and then I did Canada, and then I came home, and 2 days after I came home, there was no Borders.
Wow.
And it was one of those huge events which actually felt like I'd kind of been writing about it. The fact that I'd done a chapter about an Arab feeling lost in New York and the culture clash felt peculiarly prescient. It didn't feel dated. But yes, I definitely wanted to do more. I definitely felt like the story of Shadow that is the book, American Gods, had not finished.
So what would it look like in this post-9/11 world?
In my head, and to some extent even in reality, there is a large box in which I'm putting stuff that's going to go into American Gods number two. Mm. And there's really weird stuff. Don't know that the albacore is going to go in there, really. I say that, and then, you know, you're going to see it disappearing off down under the ground. And, but finding there's definitely more strange American things that I've found. And I think American Gods number two is going to have a lot more about the new gods, a lot more about the weird cutting edge of technology stuff. Yeah. I think I want to write about attention spans. And shorter and more minute attention spans, the upside and the downside of things like Twitter. I want to write about the peculiar nature of community and the upside and downside of that as well in this sort of electronic age. I love the fact that you can have communities which consists of people who have never met in the flesh, but they are real communities. But I'm also fascinated by the downside of that. I was talking to Lev Grossman last night. He asked me about Twitter and was talking about the power and the coolness of Twitter. I was saying, yes, well, it is wonderful up to a point. And then it completely stops. And I told him about how I'd gone off. I'd actually done that thing recently that I did 10 years ago. I'd borrowed a house from a friend in Florida, gone down there. And I'd been there for about almost 2 weeks, and was feeling kind of lonely. It's just me, on my own. I'm being pathetically nice to the people at the supermarket checkout counter because they're the only human beings I run into. That was why I grew the beard. You know, there were no human beings around to be revolted by that weird period when the beard isn't quite a beard yet, when I look faintly Neanderthal. So it was one of the last nights there, and I just tweeted something about, you know, going to bed now, got a lot of writing done, it's really lonely, or feeling fairly lonely, or something like that. And somebody tweeted back to me, and they said, how can you be lonely with 1.6 million Twitter followers? And I wrote a reply to him, and then I deleted it, because I thought, no, I'm not going to send that to him, and it seems kind of mean, and I don't know that he'd actually understand what I'm saying. But the reply to him simply said, make me a cup of tea. And
well, you do have 1.6 million Twitter followers, and I noticed that some of them get really panicked if you haven't tweeted in a couple of hours. But you use them for reactions, you know, you throw things by them, you talk about things that you're doing, you get a lot of two-way response, which is so different from my image of you writing American Gods. You know, for whatever reason, my picture is, you know, dark room, grinding out the work of a novel, endless cups of coffee.
I'm sure it'll be like that for, you know, but for American Gods too. I may well take myself completely off Twitter, for example. The people will know that I'm writing because I'm not there. They can worry about me. It'll be great.
And I'll have told them that they can yell at me if I come on Twitter. So anybody, if I actually do come on Twitter, everyone will go back to work. And I'll type, oops, and then I'll go back and work.
You could just have them endlessly making applaud sounds or something like that, too. American Gods gave so many people an introduction to all of these varied pantheons of gods. So if they are fading because of our lack of belief, did you throw them a lifeline?
There's a very odd level on which I think maybe I kind of did. I love that every now and then, these days, I will have changed things just a little with American Gods. Just because now, 10 years after it was published, it's been read by X number of million people. And once X number of million people have read things, things change. People now like to give me a rough time. They say, well, everybody knows that Easter is named after Easter. I say, yeah, but they really didn't 11 years ago. Mm. That's something that kind of, the fact that it's actually named after a pagan goddess is something, that's where the name of the festival comes from, probably, is something that was not, it really wasn't in wide currency. But truthfully, I think the fundamental mythological and cultural underpinnings of American Gods haven't changed. Mm. I wrote it as an immigrant. I wrote it as an English person coming to America, finding out to my surprise that it was filled with weird American stuff. And I'd really thought that I understood America because I'd watched lots of American TV and I'd read lots of American books. And I figured I had a handle on America. I came out here, came out to the Midwest, and it was weird. And it was that weird that I wanted to get in. But there was a specifically weird sort of cultural thing that absolutely fascinated me, which was the difference between somewhere like England and somewhere like Canada, somewhere like America, for the people coming into it. Mm. In Canada, they talk about the mosaic. They talk about cultural mosaic, that the Canadian mosaic, that you are coming from the Philippines or from China, you're coming from Greece or from Latvia, and you are contributing a little color, a little thing to the mosaic that is Canada. And in America, you have the metaphor of the melting pot, right. The thing that you get thrown in, you come out American. And the idea that that there are things that you are expected to give up. And one of those things is the weird sort of cultural baggage, the mythological baggage that you brought to this country.
Well, is that why there's a point where Wednesday tells Shadow, this is the only country in the world that worries about what it is? Nobody goes searching for the heart of Norway or the soul of Mozambique, the way that we have made a rite of passage in some way, searching for the soul of America. And is that what's missing, the magic?
I would footnote that by saying I've started to suspect these days that maybe Australians are trying to figure out what Australia is in very much the same way that Americans are trying to. But it's a very similar country. It has that thing of, things that started out
as... The place for second chances.
Yeah. And as countries of immigrants trying to figure out what they are and what they are with, native people who were sort of rather... ridden roughshod over.
Right, because Mr. Ibis, one of the things you... Is it Ibis? Ibis?
I don't know how you say it.
One of his entries is that American history is fictional. It's this charcoal sketch.
Yeah. So well, that actually began... That came out of my son coming home from school one day. And he was about 12 years old. He came home from school, was sitting there at dinner. And in that way that 12-year-old boys like to sort of drop things into the conversation, he says... My teacher says you're a liar. And I said, oh, really? He says, yes. And I said, well, why am I a liar? He says, well, you know that thing that you told us about how people were sent to America on transportation if they stole things like sheep or money and they weren't going to be hanged. They'd send them to America for like 10 years or something until they'd... And they could come back and it was like a prison out here. And I said, yeah. He said, my teacher says that's not true. And the only people who came to America were seeking freedom. And I thought, that's absolutely fascinating. The idea that this kid's history teacher has this
wonderful little Disney sketch of in her head of what happened, that bears no relationship to what happened. You know, this idea that, no, the what happened, everybody knows what happened. The history of America is pilgrims came over seeking religious freedom. They founded America on religious freedom. Then they threw tea into the harbor, proclaimed, you know, and you're sort of going, well, actually, that's not true. It's so much more interesting and complicated, and there's all sorts of shades of gray, and there's stuff going on.
Wake from your sleep. The trial, your tears today.
You're listening to author Neil Gaiman from Writers on a New England Stage, recorded in front of a live audience at the Portsmouth Music Hall. I spoke with him about the 10th anniversary edition of American Gods. The novel is about the stories and beliefs which kept folk gods powerful in the old world and the new idols of railroads and television and shopping which replaced them in the imaginations of the new world. We included questions selected from hundreds submitted by the audience, one from a librarian who wondered whether his passion for unusual stories was connected to a particular library or a librarian from his childhood in England.
When I was a kid, I would get my parents to drop me off at our local library on their way to work, and I would just head into the children's library. I would grab the card index, because it had this gorgeous card index which didn't just list books by name, but it also had subjects. So I could go, I want to read about witches. And I'd find all of the books that had witches in them, and I'd just sit there reading my way through every witch in the library or every ghost.
Well, do you have a lot of hope for the future of books?
I have huge hope for the future of books and huge hope for the future of libraries. The actual town librarian was absolutely wonderful, and I went to talk to him once because I couldn't figure out where to find the Alfred Hitchcock Presents the Three Investigators books and who'd actually written them, and whether it was by A, whether they should be under H for Hitchcock, because it didn't seem to be, and it turned out they were written by somebody else. So they were, and then he started telling me about the power of the interlibrary loan, which, when you are 10, and you are me, the discovery that you can get any book in England, it's like being given the keys to Fort Knox. You know, you have, or more than that, it's like being, you know, a proper supervillain with your own octopus pit and the button. You know, last year I had the enormous honor of being the spokesman, the honorary spokesman for National Library Week. And it really was an honor. And I remember and suddenly found myself having to do interviews explaining libraries to people and defending libraries to people. And I remember somebody sticking a microphone in my face and saying, we have the internet, why do we need libraries? And it was one of those, well, it was one of those strange, scary moments where you go, I don't actually have a prepared answer for this. And I said, look, Google will bring you back 100 million answers. A librarian will bring you back the correct one.
Aww.
And and that's true. You know, librarians, people think of them as people who put books back on shelves, and that's not what they do. Librarians know stuff. They are guardians of knowledge. They're like these sort of, you know, heroes in science fiction novels. After the end times have come, and there's one lone guy who's guarding the knowledge, one lone woman. She's got the stuff. And that's what librarians do.
Well, you reimagined The Sandman. Originally, that wasn't your character. You rewrote a screenplay for Beowulf. And I'm wondering about that experience. You just recently wrote the episode for Doctor Who, or it recently aired. Perhaps some of the people here have heard of Doctor Who.
I
just wonder what it's like to write for a character that's already sort of created instead of making up one of your own.
I was... Oh, thank you. And you have to understand that for me, something like American Gods, they say, whoa, you must love mythology. And I say, yes, I really do love mythology. I love mythology. When I was 7, my favorite book, I bought it with my own money, was Tales of Ancient Egypt. And I learned all about the Egyptian gods. And I had a copy of Roger Lanceling Green's book, Tales of the Norse Men. And I learned all about the Norse gods. And this was what I loved when I was 7. And this was, you know, mythology was so important. But then I point out to them that I started watching Doctor Who when I was about 3.5 going on 4. And long before I knew who Anubis was, or Osiris, or Odin, or Loki, I knew that TARDIS stood for, you know, time and relative dimension in space, that the Daleks came from the planet Skaro. I had a copy of this wonderful book called The Dalek World, which was this wonderful comic and text thing, and I studied it. I would read it over and over. I still have my copy, and it's just falling to pieces. The cover is gone. And from it, I learned that Daleks couldn't see the color red, which disturbed me, because there were red Daleks. And I would worry about them. So Doctor Who was part of my personal mythology, which meant that, you know, 45, 46 years later, when I'm talking with Stephen Moffat, the current Doctor Who supremo, about writing an episode, I was as happy as it was possible to be. Mm. And, you know, I got to the feeling of sheer power when I wrote that script. The first time I wrote the words interior TARDIS control room, and I thought, this must be how God feels like. You have the power. I loved doing it, and I also have to say I thought the BBC did so right by me.
We're running very short on time, so I'm going to try and ask you some questions quickly.
I'll do short answers.
All right. Star Trek or Star Wars?
Trek.
Favorite book ever?
Don't ask evil questions.
Who are you reading right now?
I'm just actually not reading it right now, because I actually have a blurb on the cover, which meant that I read it 6 months ago. But the book that I was reading today was Alina Simone's hilarious set of essays called You Must Go and Win. Mm. And just so funny and so perceptive.
She's a brilliant musician as well. Sushi, yellowtail or tuna?
Yellowtail.
Red Sox or Yankees?
As an Englishman, I am excused. It's awesome.
Okay. Gods or space aliens?
Oh, gods every time.
Of course.
But I mean, and truthfully, I love aliens. You know, I was a science fiction kid I loved SF, and I'm absolutely with Sam on heading out into the stars. Wish we'd get on with it. But gods every time.
Okay. Heads or tails?
Heads.
Ooh. Do you have one of those two-sided coins?
No,
or
but
is it all
I do.
A two-sided
I
coin?
Don't have a two-sided coin, but I do have the 1921 Liberty Head dollar that I talk about in
the book.
And I tried to make it so that if I was writing a coin trick for Shadow, I had at least done it enough that I could sort of do it. And the saddest thing about the 10 years that has passed between writing American Gods and now is now I am a fumble-fingered mess and will probably drop a coin. And back then, I could actually... And it was great for interviews.
Well, I'm wondering, you know, the storm foretold throughout the book of American Gods finally comes. And Shadow sort of realizes as he's about to address all these assembled gods that it is about belief. It is rock-solid belief that makes things happen. And I wonder what you believe in that makes things happen for you. Why do you do what you do?
I believe that stories are important. I believe that people are important. And I believe that people deserve stories. And that's true, the true, posh and noble answer. But I do what I do because, honestly, I have absolutely no other skills. I'm somebody, you do not want me driving your taxi. If you think my nice limo driver got us lost on the way here, I would have done it 1,000 times better. I still wouldn't be here. You do not want me putting up shelves. You definitely do not want me administering your hedge fund. You would have the emptiest hedge of all hedges. What I was put here for, what I do really well, is I make stuff up. When I was a little kid, adults would say to me, "You're making stuff up." And they'll say, "You made that up, didn't you?" And they'd say, "That's not true." And they'd say, "Neil, you know what will happen if you keep making things up." And I didn't. And they never told me. And eventually what I learned would happen was this. You get a beautiful theater, wonderful interviewer, and a great audience. And
please join me in giving a warm and exuberant thank you to Neil Gaiman.
Thank you. You lot are awesome.
Two jumps in a week, I bet you think that's pretty clever, don't you, boy? Flying on your motorcycle, watching all the ground beneath you drop.
Neil Gaiman, writer, filmmaker, and multimedia sensation. He's the author of the Sandman series of comics, the film Coraline, and the Hugo, Stoker, and Nebula award-winning novel American Gods, now out in a 10th anniversary edition with the author's preferred text. He joined me for the Writers on a New England Stage series, a partnership of New Hampshire Public Radio and the Music Hall in Portsmouth in collaboration with River Run Books. The executive producer and live stage presentation director is Patricia Lynch. NHPR's president is Betsy Gardella. Associate producer is Tom Holbrook of River Run Bookstore. Associate producer and director of strategic communications for the Music Hall is Margaret Talcott. Broadcast producer is Rebecca Lavoie. Live sound and recording engineer is Mike Marchand. The musical director and the band for the stage production is Bob Lord and Dreadnought. A special thanks to Taylor Quimby for this broadcast, which was made possible by New Hampshire's Heinemann Publishing, transformative resources for today's teachers and tomorrow's leaders. To hear an unedited version of my interview with Neil Gaiman, or to hear other authors from the series, visit nhpr.org and click on the Writers on a New England Stage link. To read the live blog or tweets from this event, search the hashtag NeilInNH. I'm Virginia Prescott. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
All your insides fall to pieces. You just sit there wishing you could still make love.